Good morning, good morning, good morning, and thank you for joining us on yet another episode of Face to Face Talk Show. I am your host, Sharifa Hardy, and we have an incredible show for you today. We have some very special guests who are joining us, and we have a repeat guest who was with us last week. We had so many questions. We had a great conversation that we had to bring him back. So I want to go ahead and first of all, introduce Mr. Salim, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the Constitution. Good morning, Salim. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing well. How are you?
I am excited to have you. I love your backdrop.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a very meaningful, very purposeful emblem. And that's what continues with our work today. So it's a direct representation.
You are passionate about the Constitution, which is rare. But you surprised me by some of the things that you mentioned and talked and discussed last week. I'm glad that you decided to come back because there were some points I want to talk about again today. So we're going to be right back with you. But I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest, Ms. Talia Lavery, who is joining us to talk to us about some of the things that she's passionate about, which includes marginalized people, some of which are Black women. Good morning, Talia. How are you?
Good. I'm Tali, by the way.
Tali, sorry about that.
It's okay. I'm good. Good. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you. I always tell people, if you let me get past the introductions, I'll sound a lot more intelligent. That's the most difficult aspect of what I do. All these people, names, personality, businesses, it gets confusing. But tell us why you would like to be a guest here today on Face to Face Talk Show.
I think that it's just another opportunity to get the message out there to try to reach the audience that I believe needs to hear this message. I'm an advocate for Black women in particular in the workplace and other marginalized groups that are in the workplace. And I'm also coming from a different point where I am kind of, doing a call to action to those in leadership, specifically white male CEOs that I believe have the onus is on them to create more sustainable environments for marginalized people. So just here to chop it up with you guys, see what I can learn too.
Well, thank you. We appreciate you being here to chop it up. I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest, Mr. Pronounce your name for me, please, because I was going to say it and I was going to mess it up.
It's okay. It wouldn't be the first time. I'm Adarian Larison. I am the owner of Jave Coffee and Tea. And I'm here today to talk about the impact on global Black business, not just business to business relations, but consumer to producer relations. My space is particularly focused on technology and agriculture. And the way that I do that is by creating a bridge with coffee. So that's what I'm here to talk about today.
So it's a lot more than just coffee. It's a bridge.
Way more than coffee. Yeah.
Well, you are in the right place. You are definitely in the right place. I can tell 4 minutes into the show that we're going to have a great conversation. I'll be back with you. Can I call you A? Is that offensive? Okay, because you went back on mute. Everybody stays off mute because I go all over the place.
No, that's fine. It's just some background noise and I try to limit it as much as I can.
Oh, you're fine. We didn't have people driving cross country, doing a whole on airplanes, all kind of stuff. So I don't want to be offend you because with a name like Sharifa, people are always like, can I just call you? And I'm like, no, it's Sharifa. Then I'm like, can I call you A? Paul, we got some great guests today. My co-host Paul Faust is here with us today. What's going on, Paul?
Yeah, you got my name right.
I can say that.
I'm excited. I like to always say, I tell people when I do the show, I'm the student on the show. And I hope that being a student and asking questions and learning, other people can learn through me and learn not only new facts, but also learn that it's okay to talk to people and it's okay to ask questions and not make assumptions. And I think with this guest, some of our new guests, we have a latte to talk about. You like that, Adarian? You got that? Yeah, a latte. Don't forget your wait staff, try the veal. So I'm excited to get into it. There's like a different group and there's a lot of different topics. So I get to sit back, learn, and then occasionally probe when I find the opportunity.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you for joining us. As always, like I like to say, I wouldn't have done this show without you, Paul, because you are open to the conversation and I truly appreciate you. I want to go over to Tali. Tali, I would love for you to start off the conversation because you talk about and your message is focused on marginalized individuals, marginalized people, marginalized community. What is it that you would like people who are watching the show to know?
Oh, man. It's, you know, I come from so many different angles. In my book in particular, I speak to all of the different kinds of people that offended me. I guess that's the word, hurt me when I was in corporate America. And so I think that the approach that I bring that a lot of people don't bring, I feel like there's so much, and people assume that I am this kind, that my book is like, oh, Black women can read this and be like, oh yeah, girl, I went through that. And yes, they can, and it's wonderful, and they feel validated, and it helps to tell their story. But what's different about my message is that I feel like a lot of us, we've taken all of the courses, we've done all of the soft skill lessons, we go to all the networking events, we are strong, we're educated, we're smart. But my particular message is one to the offenders. And I did this, wrote the book and created my equity and inclusion business so that I could be on the other side of things and have kind of the right to tell people about themselves in a very straightforward way, but then also in a way where I'm like, how can we come to an agreement? I just really want you to stop and listen. And I give people an opportunity to see the work experiences through a marginalized person's eyes, in particular, a Black woman. Some very specific things I write about in my book, you know, are surrounding me being Black. So I think that I'm glad now that we have more ears are open, more people are looking and wanting to hear and understand systemic racism. And systemic racism really affects us in the workplace. It's another one of those things. And so I'm just one of the many voices out here that's willing to talk, if somebody's willing to listen, about what it is that we're suffering with, and how even business leaders are missing out. You're spending too much money on lawsuits. You're not getting the best out of us. And so if we can start to talk about that and start to work together, things can change. And I also have a message for other token Blacks. I think that we have glamorized tokenism for too long. And so I'm speaking to other token Blacks and saying, we can no longer glamorize that. We can no longer allow them to use that against us and for us to use that against each other. So that's my overall message.
Well, let's talk about your book. Is your book The Confessions from Your Token Black?
Yeah, The Confessions from Your Token Black Colleague. It's written in three different parts that kind of move around throughout the book. So you have my personal stories that I endured. You have actual confessions, which are the chapters where I am confronting different groups, such as I talk to other marginalized groups. I talk directly to other tokens. I talk directly to white women in particular, who were probably 99% of the time the offenders, because they had the ear of the white male CEO. I talk a lot about their white solidarity and how when they decide to come together and create a narrative, the facts don't matter, the video doesn't matter, documentation, none of that matters, that white solidarity is so strong and that a lot of marginalized people are suffering as a result of that. And then the third part of the book is where I brought in some other professionals, white people who say, you know what, I messed up, I did that before, now I'm a professional, I'm working on the other side of things just like you are. You know what, I work with companies as their HR rep. And so I just kind of brought in these professionals and business leaders to kind of seal the deal and vouch for what it was that I was speaking as far as my message.
That's very interesting. Now, one of the things that interests me most about what you had to say is it reminds me of a conversation that we had a few weeks ago on Face-to-Face Talk Show, where I was having a particularly bad day because people were saying I was an angry Black woman. And so I was like, you know what? If they want to say I'm an angry Black woman, let's talk about it. Let's discuss it. And so we gave all these scenarios in which people looked at us as angry Black women. And then the conversation went into, well, maybe it wasn't because you're a Black woman, or maybe, you know, it was whatever it was. But can you tell us at least one of your stories in your book that happened to you?
Yeah, it's so funny, that whole maybe, you know, that's interesting to hear you say that, and kind of makes me sick to my stomach, because I'm such a very self-aware person, and I spent so many years banging my head against the wall, seeing therapists, reading all the books, saying, please, okay, let me run this by you one more time. Tell me. And it was only once I started writing the book that I was able to give myself the credit, like, girl, no, they were wrong. You were done wrong time and time again. What's one scenario I can give you? So I remember I had recently started working, and my career field was corporate meeting management. And I had recently started a role. It was an educational facility, and I was putting on a graduation for them, and we were discussing an after party, like reception, and a white gentleman who I reported to and another white woman who I would work closely with were there. And she says something about her husband coming. And I said, oh, okay, can I bring a guest? And she goes, yeah, as long as he doesn't have braids and gold teeth. And it's just like this awkward silence, like, okay.
Wow. Yeah. Salim, comment, thoughts. What are you feeling back there?
wait. So instantly went to a narrative of you got to be dating a hood. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the perception that, which is something I've never understood about America. We're always looked into the light as we are doubtful. We are maleficent. We are evil. We are, you know, anything that's derogatory. And I've never understood that. We're called lazy. Our women are called strong, but not called beautiful. Our cars are called beautiful, but not strong. And, you know, I understand what you're saying about the marginalization, because that does happen. But I do think in some ways, our not speaking out, our non-unity has allowed them to do that. Because, you know, our people, the first thing we love to do is show off. We gotta have that. We gotta make sure that everybody sees us no matter what we're doing. And the conversations that I've had this week, especially yesterday, was to guys that were called Uncle Tom, sellouts, you know, the black girls in the class that loved all the hood guys would talk down to us. So we always had to face that dichotomy. And I really want to read your book, because, you know, a lot of that stuff still happens and nobody really talks about it. Nobody talks about it. But like you said, they always put that in our face. And it's so subliminal, or it could be so, you know, under the radar, that if you get upset and you show some type of reaction, now absolutely.
Yes. Thank you, Sally. Go ahead, Tali.
I think an even greater part of the problem, and this gets really tricky, but back then I was highly offended. Do I look? What? I think too, as Black people, we have allowed them to dictate what is so hood or negative about our culture. You know, even things as simple as, why would you name your child that? I think we need to move away from that, because it reminded me that we need to move away from allowing them to use these standards, and then we take these standards and take on the shame that they've put on those particular standards or those things. It goes all the way back to slavery when they changed our names. You know, I think that, you know, us reaching and gravitating towards names that may not sound like Amy and John was us trying to grab back some of our identity. And I think, you know, we're a long way from it. I know it won't happen tomorrow, but I just want to get to the point where gold teeth and braids don't necessarily even mean negative. I've seen some brothers with gold teeth and braids that are brilliant. And I think that we as a community have to stop feeding into that. I think that we as a community need to be able to prop up and present all of our variations and things. Because here's the thing that I realized. I don't care if your name is Daquan on the corner or Obama at the Resolute desk. They see you the same. And I think that that's what we have to start to realize as Black people. It's my opinion.
Interesting point. I want to come back to that and offer my thoughts, but I would love to allow Adarian to comment any thoughts you might have on what Tali had to say.
Absolutely. It actually reminds me of one of the reasons that I left corporate America. When I left the first time, it was something pretty similar to that. And without going into it at this time, what I'll say is that we have to own our triggers. Mm.
Yes.
Point blank, period. The moment that a person knows, back up a step. How does a person know that they've triggered you? Your reaction is a required part of that participation. And it's not a measured response. It's just a gut wrench, instinctual, sometimes self-defense, fight or flight reaction. And so it's very easy to be called an angry Black person or an angry Black woman when it's very easy to identify and trigger those responses. They know if they talk about your kids at work, they're going to trigger you. They know if they talk or touch your hair, they're going to trigger you. They know that if, for example, the scenario where you were at the meeting and this person was bringing a guest, in a lot of corporate environments, it's not even apropos to even bring a guest. So for the fact that this person is going to bring a spouse who has nothing to do with the business into the meeting, that level of unprofessionalism, they would usually project on you, but because they couldn't, there was a jab. And it was a jab that would work based on their ignorance, and it was a jab that would work based on the agreed upon social norm about what people of color look like. I'll leave you with this thought about that topic. 2 years ago, I went and I was in a really pish posh part of Denver, Colorado. I love Denver, it's a progressive city for a lot of reasons. But the experience that I'll focus on is this. I went into a 5-star barbershop men's parlor type thing. And you know, this is like, they bring you an espresso, you sit down, your haircut's gonna be $48 to $65, okay? So this is an experience. And the person that greeted me has a full sleeve of tattoos, piercings here on the, you know, and I'm looking at these things and I'm saying, wow. I left that experience, went to the meeting that I was actually scheduled to attend. And the people, one of the remarks were made was, well, we couldn't tell what you were by your name. What I am? Yeah, you've got a Scandinavian last name. We couldn't tell what you were. We couldn't tell if we were going to expect somebody that was Norse, or we were going to expect somebody that, you know, was covered in tattoos and had piercings. And immediately I thought about the trigger moment. Immediately I'm thinking to myself, what the entire professionalism? You're willing to accept a person with a full sleeve of tattoos and they're seen as avant-garde, creative, entrepreneurial even. But me in a suit and professionally groomed to come and have this meeting to make the perfect, you know, impression, and you're afraid that I would show up in a, according to the social norm that is unacceptable for me. And it was then that I had to learn, it's about the triggers, because I smiled and I responded in a way that wasn't what they expected at all. It was very, I channeled my inner Paul Mooney and responded right then and there. And I'm gonna tell you why that's important for me. It's something that I wear with honor. Shouts out to Paul Mooney, seriously. Comedy is something that disarms people's discomfort. And what makes it so disarming is that it is offensive. People are oftentimes so caught in the loop of what's socially acceptable in their minds that they're perfectly okay being offensive. I was working on something and a person said, you know, they didn't agree with an assessment that I made. And they said, oh man, you must be smoking crack.
What?
That was an appropriate response for them. I could tell by the cut of this person, they had never seen crack before. I grew up in New York City in the 80s.
Right?
Where do you find the stones to even make that remark? But it was something that was so appropriate for them that everyone else just kind of brushed it as if, yeah, that's ridiculous. And so,
I don't want to cut you off.
Owning triggers, that's it.
Adarian, but that's what I tend to do and why people tune in to face-to-face talk show. Because yeah. I'm listening to you and I'm listening to both examples. And I've been in those situations where, especially with a name like Sharifa, I show up to meetings and people don't know what to expect. They haven't, you know, they haven't looked at a picture. They don't know who I am. And this is what we do. We have conversations here. So I'm not negating anything that you said. I'm just simply asking a question. I think that people are often surprised when they meet me, but that wouldn't be an instance where I look at it and go, okay, well, this person is being racist, because they don't know what to expect. They don't know if I'm Black, white, Hindu, Muslim, you know, where I'm from. So they don't know what to expect. The other thing is, I've been, you know, in conversation with people who have said, you know, you must be smoking something, you must be smoking crack. But would you attribute that to, if you were not a Black man, they would not have used that phrase?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll tell you why. Starting with the crack statement first. Mm-hmm. They make the statement in jest, assuming that I have a point of reference. So you got to understand, break it down for the etymology of what comedy is, the ingredients. In order for me to find that funny, I have to find it offensive or ridiculous too. So you automatically assume that I knew the reference. That's very offensive, because I've seen people say, actually scream profanities in board meetings, and their reply from their counterparts was, well, I think you're a little off keel, or I believe that you may have missed the mark, or we'll talk about this offline. These are all very MBA appropriate phrases to redirect, an altercation. But when you tell a person of color in a meeting that they must be smoking crack,
so are you saying that you don't feel like they even feel the need or give you respect to read and adjust to who you are as a person? It's just, you're Black, I can say this.
Listen, and that one statement, how many times, just think for a second, in your professional career, how many times has a person of non-color pulled you to the side and said, with a jib or any type of reference, you know, I can say this to you because, you know where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've had that happen.
That's like starting a statement with no offense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, whatever comes next is going to be offensive.
I want to jump in because a lot to unpack. Straddling the line between racism and lack of education or exposure. Coming up as a white kid in Westchester County, you know, what did I see growing up that Black were? What was I exposed to? They were in the TV shows. They were criminals, right? They were always the bad guy, dressed with the gold tooth and the like, whatever. And or when they started to put on other shows, it was Different Strokes, where the rich white guy brought the kids out of the hood. It was even the French Prince of Bel-Air, where you had to pull the black kid out of the hood to make him respect. So I think we walk a fine line between racism, which is, I believe it, and ignorance. You know, I remember a story that happened to me where I was, I think I told you, Sharif, where I was at a Burger King and I ordered food, and the woman behind the counter was like loading up my French fries. And I said, load it up, like fill it up with fries. And she looked at me and she said, are you trying to Jew some fries? Now I'm Jewish, and at first I stopped and I looked at my friend. I was like, you didn't just say that in a work environment. But then I took a step back and realized that she wasn't being anti-Semitic. She didn't know that the term was offensive to me. She didn't know that saying, are you trying to juice the fries? It's totally inappropriate anywhere. And obviously she didn't know I was Jewish, because, you know, I could hide my Jewishness, the minority of being a Jew. I could hide. I can't hide being Black. So I just think that we need to start out with the education and the understanding of other cultures and names and ways of acting, and sort of teach, like take a step back and teach, and not just assume everyone is necessarily racist or malicious. I 100% understand and agree with everything you said, because I have caught myself since doing the show with Sharifa, catching myself thinking a certain way. And I'm going, and I'm like, am I now thinking about this more because I'm more cognizant? And it is, because I've been educated, because I never understood these things, systematic racism.
In order to really address that, though, you have to acknowledge two things. Both racism and education are systemic.
Yes.
I agree completely.
And they're systemic. And I would offer the following, too. Let's say for a second, they didn't know. They didn't know that they didn't know.
Okay.
We live in a world where they can afford to not know.
Yeah.
They can afford to not know on the subway.
I think that's one of the biggest statements that has been said on this show since we started doing it. We live in a world where people think it's okay to not know. And by the way, I was one of them. I was one of them saying, hey, I made it to 50 years old. I'm okay. Oh, there's some riots going on and some people are okay. This is concerning, but it's okay for people not to know. And I said, no, it's not okay, because we're never going to change if I don't know. I'm never going to understand if I don't know, because I can't pretend to know until
it happens. It happens in person to person interactions, and it definitely happens in business. It happens in politics. You know, I find it's almost comedic at this point that a person with braids and gold teeth would be considered offensive, but the most negative and most diabolical people that I've ever seen or witnessed or read about were clean-shaven white men who dressed in suits.
That's an interesting statement. Interesting statement. Now, Salim, you were going to, I want you to respond, Salim. You were going to say something.
Well, so I really agree with Adarian. I really agree with that. And it shows in the corporate world of how things are. Now, Paul, I understand exactly what you're saying, that we have to educate and we have to make these steps in order to do that. But we have been telling our story since the beginning of time. The Greeks wrote it down different. The Romans wrote it down different. The barbarians wrote it down different. The Norse wrote it down different. Then we have these trigger words that have used in common language now. The founding fathers, the freedom fighters, the patriots. The problem what it is that a lot of people overstep is labels. When we label something, automatically we treat it to the label that we define it. So we don't look at Blacks as Hebrews. We don't look at Blacks as Neolites or Aztecs or Olmecs. We look at them as just Black. So when we put that stigma on a word, because I've never seen in my DNA, which came back 56% Native American, I've never seen it come back saying, you're from a land called Black. You're called Black. You're from Negro. You know, oh, you're labeled an African American, but none of us has ever been to Africa. None of us has ever lived there. None of us even can prove that our descendancies are from there. Because during the times of slavery, you had people from South America put in India, people from India put in China, people from China put in America. You had them mixed all over and everywhere. So when it comes to educating a public, the public has to be willing to do it. Because we have a time now, you think about it like this, all right? Everybody sat in history classes and we heard the same regurgitated stories. Christopher Columbus found America, which that was a lie. Then it skips to that these people were just coming over here to seek religious freedom. Who goes 3,000, 4,000 miles over an ocean to find God? It never happens. You know, so we would null to sleep, and our education, our systems, our anything were always put to the background. So when they label us Black, when they label us Negro, when they label us African-American or color, look at what they're treating us like. Black means unknown. In science, it means death. So when you're saying all Black, well, Black lives matter, you're basically saying no lives matter. When you're saying you're Black, you're negating everything about a person because you're putting a label on that person. I can't look at Sharifa and say, well, I wonder this, I wonder that. That's the basis of judgment right there. You're not allowing that person to be a person. I think now in 2020, we have been so far removed from this anti-social network that we don't know how to treat humans like humans anymore, unless you fit a status quo. Now, if you're a blonde, blue eyes, live in suburbia, you can run through all day never facing racism, never facing brutality, never facing anything. But the problem of it is what is going to make that person look to their neighbor and see what they're going through to pick it up and use that for themselves? That's the problem. So many times Europeans have, and I'm not going to say white because I don't believe in crayon colors. Europeans, when they came over here and occupied these lands, twisted a narrative. They twisted a narrative about slavery. They've twisted a narrative about the Constitution. They've twisted a narrative about law, politicians, anything like that. And now that it's in full-fledged, they're like, wait, hold on. We need to be peaceful and we need to start doing these things. We need to start doing this. But no legislation is changing behavior. When Barack Obama was in office, now you got to think, Barack Obama's a constitutional attorney. And he's one of the first in recent years, and that's a fact. When he was going through his second election, do people remember how Fox News, CNN, and all those places, Rush Limbaugh was talking about him? We're talking about a man that's not from the ghetto, that's never been broke or poor, that has no relation to Black people except for his skin color. And they call him Obama the Magic Dragon. They're calling his wife a transsexual. She looks like a gorilla that needs to play in the NBA. And no one ever said anything of like, we're talking about our president of the United States. We're talking about our commander. But you can't even call Donald Trump a racist without somebody standing up and saying something. So it's about that respect issue that when people look at a skin color and you have a large amount of melanin in you, whether you're light skin, high yellow, or you blurple, they always put you as you're Black. They're always going to put this label on you, and they can do that. That's the problem. You know, we have our significant problems and everything too, but when it comes to education, who's going to listen to us? In LA, if I'm not mistaken, I'm from New York.
Paul said he's listening. No, I got it. I want to, because you, Salim, you're so many different points.
I'm sorry.
So no, it's good. It's great. I just try to attack them one at a time because I want to go way back to something that Adarian said. I mentioned this several times on face-to-face talk show. What I've seen that's different in this point of time in history, aside from any other point of time in history, and I'm 44 years old, is I've never met so many people who were not Black come to me or on panel say, Sharifa, I didn't know. I didn't know. I had a lady said to me, she on a panel, and Paul knows by now, I'm probably like a moody person. So it depends on what day, what time you catch me is going to determine the response. So this lady, I felt she was genuine. She was pouring her heart out. She was like, but Sharifa, I didn't know. Can you just explain it to me? You know, I didn't know. And so I asked her, I said, well, you know, you asked me that, but let me ask you this question. What part didn't you know? Like, what part did you miss out? Did you miss slavery? Did you miss Jim Crow? Did you miss the civil rights movement? Like, give me a specific time in history that you didn't know about so I can explain that time for you. But when you just say, I didn't know that there was systematic racism, I didn't know that Blacks were going through all these injustices, that's when I'm kind of like, I understand the whole bubble idea, but you had no idea?
Sharifa, the truth is they didn't care. And a lot of them still don't.
Bingo.
Okay, now there's more that are attempting to care now. Some care because their heart was really broken when they saw George Floyd. You know, some of it really was a wake-up call. Some care because they feel guilty by, you know, everything that's going on. Some care because they feel like it's going to affect their bottom dollar. So they, you know, they have their different reasons for caring, but they never had any motivation to really care. So there's a difference between, oh, we got to respect them because they didn't know, and people who don't care, especially those who are choosing not to care now. That's really like, it's, we just have to acknowledge that they don't care.
And so they it doesn't cost them to
I
care.
Don't know as an excuse. And I believe that in the world that we live in with all the digital, everything moving, it's too much in your face now for you to be talking about you didn't know. At least I should, if I see that you don't know, I should be matched with that at least you care and that you're trying. But if you're just walking around oblivious, like, well, I didn't know, you're racist. To me, that ignorance and that racism goes hand in hand to me.
So, Talisa, let me ask you one question, because I don't disagree with you at all, which is why I come on the show every week, because I was also the person, not that I didn't know, is that I knew a little bit, but it was okay not to do anything about it because it didn't affect Paul. Yeah. Like, yeah, I knew.
It didn't apply to you.
Right. Well,
Paul, with respect, did you feel in that time period that it just didn't apply to you?
Well, not only did it not apply to me because I never was the subject of you know, much overt racism, but I knew that things were off and that people were treated a certain way, et cetera. But it's sort of like, okay, well, that's really not going to affect Paul's life. So I don't have to go learn and get better because, you know, you're like, well, okay, that's horrible. But, you know, but Paul, you're okay. Like now, if, as I said, when I was in college, I stood up and this was, when I was 20, I stood up when I saw an injustice. And I said, wait a minute, I don't understand this. So I knew maybe deep inside that something mattered to me, but you know, you're like, all right, well, I don't want to get involved in that. So it's not that I didn't know. It was maybe I didn't know anywhere near what I knew now that I watched 13th, that I'm reading now, that I'm sitting on the show and getting educated, but it's easy to go, okay, but that doesn't affect me. But it goes back to that old quote that, and I don't know it exactly, but it was like, when they came for the X, I didn't stand up because I wasn't an X. And then when they came for the Y, I didn't stand up because I wasn't a Y. And then when they came for the so-and-so, I didn't stand up. But then when they came for me, there was no one left to stand up. And that, and that's why I've said, you know what? The system of saying, I didn't know and it doesn't affect me, so back up, doesn't work. It's not affecting change. It's getting worse. So here's the only way we're going to get better. Doing is greater than talking. I'm trying to talk, I'm trying to do, I'm trying to learn, and then I'm trying to talk to other people because we could change small. But look, I also, let me be also, you know, we're talking about Black and racism. Let's also be honest. Everyone out there in the world knows there's anti-Semitism. The Jews have been persecuted. There was a time in New York the Jews were getting beat up in the streets for being Jewish. I didn't see a lot of people running to learn about anti-Semitism and step up either. Now, I do respect that I could hide being Jewish. When I leave my hotel room, nobody looks at me and says, oh, there's a Jew in room 6089 versus staying at a casino and being Black. So I understand there's a difference, but all I can do is say, I don't like the status quo. Paul, you're gonna have to get uncomfortable and learn and be learning. Try and bring the message to others through this show and talk. That's all I can do. Yes. I can't go backwards.
Yes. Well, I appreciate you talking. I appreciate the conversation. Talib, you were making a comment when Paul was speaking.
Are you insinuating that we are holding you accountable to more? Because when you say that's all I can do, it comes across kind of defensive, like, whoa, whoa. I'm just curious.
Not me personally. Okay. I think that, and I think that the message out there is, didn't know, didn't hear, doesn't work. And if everybody doesn't wake up and realize it, that doesn't work, not just about racism, about gun control, about the environment, about anything you don't like, that it doesn't affect me, doesn't work anymore. And you have to do things and learn things that don't maybe necessarily affect you on a day-to-day basis because it affects us. And, you know, there is no me without an us. So you have to, now, that doesn't mean you have to go learn about every single topic and every single thing in the world and go fight for change everywhere. But you can't just keep your head in the sand because it doesn't affect you. No, so I'm not, you know, I'm trying to do what I can because I've recognized my own fallacies, my own lack of education in certain topics, and that it's not acceptable. And I'm a parent coming up. And maybe you're not going to teach an old dog the new tricks, but I got two new dogs for my kids that I can bring up differently and hope that we have generational change.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that remind me of when you were talking about quotes, Paul, one of the things that I thought you were going to say is one of my favorite quotes by Edmund Burke, all that is necessary for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing. And mm-hmm. that's the main thing. You know, it's like in this world, there are so many more good people than there are bad people. But when people sit and do nothing and allow things to happen, that's why we wind up in these situations. Adarian, I would love for you to comment.
Okay, so a lot of great Adarian, insight.
Adarian, I hate to cut you off, but I want to tell before you talk, I'm going to tell you, but before we started the show, if someone had asked me, is there systemic racism in the United States? I would say, I don't know. I don't think so. I don't see it.
Right.
Now that I've educated myself, now that I've stepped back and said, no, this is systemic, because I've learned, I've read, I've watched, I've talked. Yeah, but it was, I didn't see it the way, as deep as it was, until I started.
And you know what though? It kind of goes into my reply. I want you to consider something. I could tell you, we could have an entire conversation on the didn't know and the effect of it, but it really just boils down to these two things. It's expensive and it's uncomfortable. Period.
Agreed.
Period. That's true. And that's why, you know, I can pick up, I've never met any of you. I could pick up my phone when we get off this call and Google anything I want to know about you, your previous five addresses, your credit history, or your friends, your next of kin, if I wanted to. So walking around saying that I didn't know, when you're being waterfed, you know, watershed with information, let's call it what it is. It's inconvenient.
Yes.
It's uncomfortable. Because if I acknowledge that I do know, I now have to decide to be apathetic. I have to decide that it doesn't apply to me and that it one day won't apply to me. Okay, so that's that part. Here's where just good old fashioned greed comes in. Along with being systemic, you have to, I mean, just really close your eyes and acknowledge that today you are still spending cotton money.
Mm.
Today, whether you touch it or not, you are still benefiting and therefore not benefiting from systems of colonial influence. They exist today. And I see it a lot in coffee specifically, because this is the virtue of what I do. A lot of the places that you go for the things that I do are very colorful places. They're full of women, they're full of children, they're full of brown people, black people, poor people, people who can read, people who can't read. They're full of those things, but you know what they're not full of? Wealthy black people. You know what they're not full of? People who know the value of their dollar. And what they're not full of is people who can afford to not give a damn. It goes back to my statement. It's not that they can afford to be ignorant. I can't. We're not going to talk about privilege because that's a slippery slope, and I could do that all day. But consider this. Consider that in any of the scenarios that you could think of about your ignorance, Paul, or Talisa, am I saying your name?
Talisa.
Okay, Talisa, your experience in corporate America. In any of those experiences, was the person of color that walked in the room expected to know the unwritten or unspoken code of behavior and ethics and how to carry oneself?
You just put my whole book. Come on.
That's the point.
Then it's they not change that the you, code in the middle of the process.
Oh, they're gonna keep doing that. And I want to be very clear and very dynamically clear about something. When I say they, I'm not talking about white people. I'm talking about ignorant people. I'm talking about people who want to remain comfortable. Okay? Don't ever romanticize this theory that black people, African people, or Pan-African people are not part of this experience. Don't do it.
Go ahead, Talisa.
Okay, it's two things that is with me. And, you know, I was thinking about, so pre-George Floyd, you know, I didn't know. It was way more socially acceptable pre-George Floyd for you not to only not know, but to reject the truth when it came before you.
Absolutely.
So, I can't tell you how many times I've tried to subtly present things, because even then, guess what? it wasn't acceptable for me to straight up tell you, this is microaggression. You haven't, you know, so we were subtly walking around. We were handling it. We were broken. We were beaten down. We were having to keep it to ourselves. And if we even thought about trying to mention it or show you or point you that way, you guys
uncomfortable
ways of just pushing us back and making us
angry,
the wrong one, making us angry. And when I heard you say anger, I'm like, we're human. We have a right to be angry. And right. Racism is real. So if I tell you that my boss is being racist, she being racist. It has to be. So white people developed this thing where it was like, you can't even hint at that. And because we have the power, we can just get rid of you. We can just get, and it further feeds into that system. The second point that I thought about, when all of this stuff first started happening and people was walking around with their flags and their big guns, and I gotta protect my rights, my freedoms. And I just started thinking like, what is going on? It ain't that. It's this subconscious desire to protect their white supremacy. Like, how dare you think that now because, you know, we put up the black squares for a few days and we said, yeah, that was really horrible for George, but do you think now you're going to be equal to me? Because when I get up in the morning and see my white skin, I have to see that I am supreme. And that's what the whole protecting my freedoms and this and that. And so it goes back into what Adarian is saying. It was like, I don't want to risk giving up this comfort. I don't want to risk giving up my privilege. I don't want to risk the potential for you to now judge my work versus the black girl's work, because I know that I've been doing 50% less than she's been doing for years. And now you mean to tell me I got to step up and become, ooh, I got to protect that. No. I can do it. And I'm going to hold it. I don't want to go that far, but yeah. A lot of protection.
It's a lot there. It's a lot. I hear you. Yeah. And I'm here
taking certain risk to hold on to your own privilege.
Oh, yeah.
I'll stop there.
A lot of interesting comments there. Salim, I would love to hear your thoughts.
I mean, it's like, where do you start? Because I agree with everything so much. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I know is Dick Gregory said this the best, and I probably said this before, but Baba said, truth never needs to be verified by ignorance. Mm. So I'm not going to come from an ignorant perspective. I'm going to come from it from truth. So when we talk about America, what was America built on? It wasn't built on finding freedoms. It wasn't guaranteeing freedoms for people. It wasn't that. It was some occupationists that came over, took some people as prisoners of war, because it was a world war going on at that time. Because the Moors had went in and helped some of your ancestors, Paul, the Jews had called the Moors in 700. Now, we came through and we did a lot of things. What did Europe do? They casted us out of history. What did Asia do? Casted us out of history. Broken in this place called the Middle East, which is part of Africa. Never did. Never, never would they believe us. Then we stopped believing in ourselves. The thing about the Constitution is, a guy asked me yesterday, and he's in his 20s. He said, what does the Constitution not protect me against? And I said, white supremacy. It's the biggest religion in the world. It's the biggest government in the world. It is the mind frame and the privilege of the world. And this is the reason why I say that. When you mentioned back in New York when the Jews were getting beat up and everything like that, at the same time in Connecticut, upstate New York, and New Jersey, tribes of Native Aboriginal people were trying to fight an identification that had been placed on them since the 1790s, called Negro or Black, when they were actually Indians or Aboriginal American, indigenous people. Now, when the Jews and all those people were fighting, we all looked at that as like, that's a European problem. That has nothing to do with us. Because at the time, when Manhattan was taken over, when Seneca Village was getting run down, nobody stepped up for the so-called indigenous people at that time. Every time that we have brought a America, is we always greeted with, I don't know. So Emmett Till happened in 1955. How did you miss that? Rodney King happened in 1991. How did you miss that? OJ showed the corruption of the system where our own people didn't even believe that he was innocent. So one thing that we have to understand is that white supremacy is the oppression that is given to us as a tool to oppress ourselves and to keep serving a system of privileged people. Now, I'm not saying all of them can be of one color, you ignorance can spread very, very nice. Now, what I know, and the studying the Constitution, studying everything that I have, the problem that I have with today, right now, is during segregation. We had a time where we had our own things. Look at Durham, look at Winston, Jackson Ward, Tulsa, look at all those places. We had everything ourselves. We took everything that we had and set it aside and said, we want to ride on yours and let all of it dry up. That's one problem that we have. And when people talk about racism, let's define racism for what it actually is. Racism is when privilege and power come together that you can thwart somebody's life or have a direct influence on them. Meaning, if you don't have power, you can't be racist. Now, the reason why I hold a lot of Caucasians to bat for this, and especially some of my brothers or Jewish brothers, the reason why is because they own everything. They control it. They tell you what they're going to do and what they're not going to do and all that. Now, if you remember the scene in The Godfather, the young Italian man went up there and he asked the cops, why are you guys not protecting my father? You guys not protecting my father? And he comes up here to protect his father. What does he do? Police come up here, break his jaw, and beat him up. And he's asking, why didn't you protect my father? Basically saying, why didn't you do what you said you were going to do? Well, we've been asking that same question since the 1400s. Why are we treated like less than animals? Dogs have more rights than we do. I mean,
present day.
People have to understand, if Michael Vick was Ben Roethlisberger, it would have been swept under the rug. Michael Vick didn't even fight dogs, but now he has to classify and do all this. When Harvey Weinstein gets together, I don't see we all looking at Jews as being racist. When Stalin was doing what he was doing, we didn't look at all Italians as their mob members and things like that. But it's so common to look at a group of Black people and say they're all the same, they're all this way, and I can look at them all the same. But when you bridge it to the other side, it's individualism. Well, I don't think like that. Well, all of us are not like that. Well, all of us are not like that either. We're fighting a system of white supremacy that people do not want to define. They do not want to understand, because like my brother and sister or my kings and queens have said before, it is uncomfortable and is expensive. If you look at cotton, when Brother A made the comment of saying that we're still spending slave money, I don't think people really understand what he's saying, how much money was being made then. Do you know cotton, just cotton, you could take any time of the 1800s, 1700s, or whatever. Do you know cotton outsold every other industry in America combined? That's the railroads, the port industry, tobacco, farming, anything. You could add all, banking, all that. You could add it all up together.
I heard that tulips was a pretty big one.
Which one?
Which one?
Do you know anything about that? Tulips.
We didn't hear you. Tulips. Speak up a little.
Tulips. Apparently, tulips were supposed to be really big. So I don't know. I was just wondering if
tulips were, dandelions were. There were a lot of flowers. So at that time, the South only mainly did cotton. It was only like North Carolina and Virginia that did tobacco. But most of the Southern states did cash crops. The Northern states is where they did all the agriculture. So when people talk about the Civil War and everything like that, and they praise Lincoln, Lincoln broke several constitutional things trying to go into that war. Lincoln was not a pro for ending slavery. Lincoln owned slaves. The last slave-owning president was Ulysses S. Grant. That's a fact. You can look these things up. There's records. There's all these things that they have. So you think about the things that they looked at when they came to this land. They used us, because there is no foreigner can come to a new land and grow anything. If they told us to go back to Africa right now, we couldn't even grow the weed that we smoke.
You know? I hear you, Salim. I hear you. Excellent point. I always love when you are a guest on the show. So much information, so much research, so much experience, so much history has been put into it. I hope all of you decide to join us next week. If you want to come back to continue this conversation, please feel free to let me know. Now, we are coming down to the last few minutes of the show, and what I love to do at the end of every show is just simply allow my guests the opportunity to speak directly to the audience, to everyone who is watching the show live, as well as everyone who is watching in the archives, and simply let them know what you want them to take away from your appearance here today. And we're going to start with you, Adarian.
Okay, so First of all, thank you for bringing me on the show. What I would like, simply put, as a takeaway, is understand that the experience of people of color to produce food, clothing, shelter, and every other good that's being produced all over the world is a global experience. It's not an American thing. It's not even a black or a white thing. Those things are constructs that no longer even fit. It goes down to those two things, comfort and expense. It is now expensive. We are costing ourselves money to still abide by these prejudices and these limits, because they're keeping us from being what we can do. My business, the way we do it is we're farmers. I have a farm, I have 64 acres, and I sell directly to consumers.
Oh, wow.
And the reason that I do that is because it's a direct way to empower the people who are producing what's being consumed. Okay. The second thing goes back to the statement about being uncomfortable. And this is where it's best to be brief. We all are comfortable. It doesn't matter if you really take a closer look at your vantage point, we're all comfortable. I'm comfortable. You're comfortable. Everybody's comfortable in their mindset, in their point of view. It's time to get uncomfortable. Because the moment you get uncomfortable, that's when the magic happens. So it's not about socioeconomic pressures or even the balance or recognition into a system that wasn't designed for you. You might be comfortable asking. I need you to get uncomfortable. Get uncomfortable asking for it. And get, you know, think globally. Stop thinking in English. Don't even belong to you. Visit my website, Jave Coffee, jave.coffee. And find us on Instagram at Jave, JAVAE.coffee. And you can read a lot more about what we're doing with agriculture, tech, and cryptocurrency and all of those other things. But stop thinking in English and get uncomfortable.
I like it. That's what we do here on Face to Face Talk Show. We ask the hard questions and we have the uncomfortable conversations. And I would say today, this is one of the more interesting shows because we have a lot of new people, new topics, and I enjoyed it today. Salim, what are you going to leave us with?
I would just want to say to all the panelists here that I am blessed to be in your presence. You could have been anywhere else, but we are all here together due to the divine and due to the ancestors bringing us together. I know that this time is very, very uncomfortable. It is very, sometimes it seems astringent. But I want you to imagine, walk like you got a million ancestors behind you. And the reason why I say that is because we need to start taking our power back. We really need to open our eyes and look at each other as human. If you want to look at somebody and want to say, what do they are, call them brother, call them sister. You can't be mean to your brother or your sister or anything like that, because we're all part of this human family. But truth is also within love. And I want everybody to remember that. The more discussions that we have can lead to more actions, but we got to be truthful in that and diligent in it. We got to get up and start doing things. There is no more excuses. There's no more anything. So what I always want to say to people, embrace the Constitution. I'm not saying that that's the main thing of life, but what it does is it gives you a way to look at things in a more broader scale, to look at the human population, even though who was written by or whatever, it does not matter. It is a founding framework that we can't operate something under. We are very smart people. We are knowledgeable people. We can do these things that we set our minds to. If we want to do this, it will happen. If we don't, we will just sit back and let it not happen. I'm Salim Amir Bey at com. I mean, I could go on all day.
I know, and we really don't have the time. We're like 1 minute away, but I appreciate it. Tyler, what do you have for us?
You know what? Luckily, I am just going to be quick. Thank you. This has been so great. I didn't know what to expect. It's been a happy accident, a pleasant, you know, thing for me to run into. I'm really happy. And you guys, you can reach me at yourtokenblackcolleague.com. I'm looking for organizations and book clubs and women's group and professional groups to come and speak to all the time. So yeah, yourtokenblackcolleague.com. Thank you.
Yes, you can make it happen. We enjoy you being on the show. Definitely hope you decide to come back, because I want to talk a little bit more about your book and what you have going on. So if you're interested, let me know. Now, Paul, interesting show. You're going to take us out, but I know some of these shows aren't always easy. We have shows where people have broken down in tears, crying from the emotion that they felt from what's going on during the day. We've had people come on the show who are angry. Some things get a little tense, but each and every time you hang in there, you stick in there, and you're like, you know what? I want to show that I care. What do you want to take us out with, Paul?
I think I have to take us out with what Darian said. Yeah, the show was more uncomfortable. The show was a little tougher. It was not as friendly and open as some of the other shows. It was tougher, but you know what? We got to be uncomfortable. I'm okay being uncomfortable. So I think that it's okay to be uncomfortable and come in and don't take it personally. Be uncomfortable. It's where I'm going to learn. It's where I think we could all learn, and where we get, I have to take some of my blows and learn a little bit. And so I have to leave it at that. And, everyone knows where to find me. They could find me here every week. I am coming here because I know that by having these conversations, we are going to change things. It's not going to be tomorrow. I can tell you, for me, it's been from when we started, but we are going to change. So keep coming and keep talking. If you're angry, come and talk. It's a safe spot to talk. I'm going to ask questions that I don't know, and I'm going to probe to get better. So come on the show, talk. It's a safe environment. And if we talk, we move. So yes. Stop talking, we're done.
Yes, yes, yes. I believe that. Let's talk. That's what we do here on Face to Face Talk Show, where we have, like we said, we have the uncomfortable conversations, we ask the hard questions, but change starts with the conversation. So like Paul said, please don't just watch the show, join the conversation, join us on Face-to-Face Talk Show. If you are interested in being a guest, please visit the website at ashsharifa.com. Until next week, Wednesday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, everyone have a safe and a blessed day. Bye now.